Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 93, The Poet X by Elizabeth Acevedo.
Mommy says, there be no clean in men's hands. Even when the dirt has been scrubbed from beneath nails, when the soap scent from them suspends in the air, there be sins there, girl. Their washed hands know how to make a dish rag from your spine. They will wring your neck. Don't look for pristine handling when men use your tears for pine saw. They'll mop the floor with your pride. There be no clean there, girl.
I began writing poetry when I was about 8 years old. And I would say that my background probably went even prior to before I knew how to write.
Their fingers were made to scratch dirt, to find it in the best of things. Make your heart a Brillo pad. Riddled in steel, don't be no damn sponge. Their fingers don't know how to squeeze nicely, nightly. If you imagine men's kisses, soft touches, a caress. Remember Adam was made from clay that stains the hand. Remember that Eve was easily tempted.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we take a thorough look at one piece of literature we both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. As always, I'm Tom Paneris, and with me along for this poetic journey of sorts is Stella. How are you?
It is Stella in my new digs. Yes. But you know, in a different state, separate from good old Tom. I'm doing mostly okay. We're in like the literal heat of summer. And you know, if people don't believe in global warming yet, please believe it now. But yeah, for the most part, taking it easy and getting to read some books and prep for the school year and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's been what the heat index down here has been like 105 every day. Yeah. I barely go outside, so because it's just too hot. And you were just saying before I'm offline that you haven't had the chance to really go exploring where you are in Maryland.
But. Yeah, because I like to do outside sort of things, but mm-hmm. it's like there's a reservoir that I could rent a kayak, and I'm like, well, that'd be great, but also I'll be smack dab like in an area where the sun is beating on me.
Yeah.
There's actually a really nice pool where I live, so I have been like, I took the Poet X out and read it, and then got really hot, and then went into the water, and then came back and read. So that's been relaxing when I've had the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, and it's safe to read the Poet X in public, unlike the smut you usually read.
Yes, that is quite true.
That's good. Yeah, I'm in smack in the middle of summer. I'm literally leaving for vacation like a couple days after we record this. So, of course, when this gets released, I will have gone back to work, and you will have a few more weeks left because you're starting after Labor Day this year. So
crazy. Yeah,
I know. But no, so it should be really interesting. We'll have to see how things are going a month in.
Yes.
So when we hit,
and we'll see each other, I guess, just after record September.
Yeah, we'll see each other. So that'll be pretty cool. So.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So we are talking about The Poet X. Elizabeth Acevedo is our author. This is a novel in verse, which means that it is, while it is a couple hundred pages, 350 something pages, at least in my paperback edition that I have, it is every single page is a poem written from the point of view of the main character. So this is a completely different form than we're used to reading. So I guess my question is for you, we always talk about our history with the book, and obviously that's one of the questions I have, but what's also the history like of you with this type of book?
Yes. So I was unaware of novels in verse until I took a YA literature course for my graduate program at the University of Virginia. And in fact, I would have been doing it right now this time last year, so 2023, if we're to date the show. And week zero, so like an assignment before even the course began, was to read Jason Reynolds' For Everyone. And I recommend that. It's a powerful piece, especially if you're like feeling down about where you are in your life and you feel like you're not being successful or you haven't achieved anything. I think that that's a really great work to read. And that was like my first experience of, you know, having a story or a message, but presented in this unique way. And then The Poet X, I'm trying to think if it was I'm trying to think what the other choice was. But I recall sending my syllabus to you, Tom, and I think also to my friend Cindy, because she has a lot of YA novels, to see like which ones do you have. And I remember that it came highly recommended. And so The Poet X was like the first one, plot wise, that I had ever thoroughly read. And I think there was one other one that we read in the scheme of things as well, about an immigrant. So this was my experience, and I'm so happy that I took that course for a variety of reasons, but one of them, and probably one of the foremost, being what we were given, the options given to read, and then I was introduced to this new genre, which is just amazing.
Yeah, and I remember, in fact, you have my hardcover copy.
I do, thank you.
Yeah, because I have a box full of like 30 of them in my classroom, because this is part of what's going to be a novel in verse unit that I'll be doing my freshman next year. My history with the genre goes back to Kwame Alexander, who wrote, who's written a few novels, mostly sports centered. And the one that I've read was called Swing, because he came to AHS to speak, and I brought my class down there and everything. And then they had like a ton of copies in the library, so I went and grabbed one. And I found the form really, really interesting. And from there, read, I think, like one or two others. There's a Jason Reynolds one that I've read called Long Way Down. That's also on that list that I'm going to be doing. That is really, really powerful. This book was part of the teacher book club that my librarian runs, so that we can get professional development points, relicensure points, just for basically reading a book and then having a discussion about
that it. That is like the best way to get professional development points, honest.
Yeah, well, I love it. I read this, another novel that both of us read, because you read it for your course, The Firekeeper's Daughter. Yeah. That was from that book club. So I had like several that were like, these were really, you know, that were really, really good. So it's one of my favorite things to do to get those points, because, you know, it's worthwhile, right? So I read this, I'd read that since, and this is my second time reading it as well. I have also read one of her other books, which is called With the Fire on a High, because I saw when that was like came out new and was in the library, so I checked it out having read this one. So yeah, so I found I guess we'll get into the form and everything, but I do find it pretty easy to follow. And I you know, I'm sure that there are some that have their strengths and weaknesses across the genre. I was recently reading one that's on this unit list, which I liked, but it was not as rich as this one was. So yeah, we'll get into that as we go. So I'll give you guys a little bit of the book's history as well as the real life history of the author. I'm taking this as just the author bio from her website. So Elizabeth Acevedo is the Young People's Poet Laureate and the New York Times bestselling author of The Poet X, which won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature, the Michael L. Prince Award, and the Cora Belpre Award, the Carnegie Mellon, and the Boston Globe Horn Book Award, and the Walter Award. She's also the author of With the Fire on High, which was named the best book of the year by the New York Public Library, NPR Publishers Weekly, and the School Library Journal, and Clap When You Land, which is a Boston Globe Horn Book Honor Book and a Kirkus finalist. She holds a BA in Performing Arts from the George Washington University and MFA in Creative Writing from the University of Maryland. She has been a fellow of Cave Canem, Canto Mundo, and a participant in the Callaloo Writers Workshops. She's a National Poetry Slam champion and resides in Washington, D.C. with her love. The book itself was released on March 6, 2018. It was a New York Times bestseller. Reviews for the book were pretty much overwhelmingly positive. There's a very long book, a review by Della Farrell from the School Library Journal. She says it was magnificently crafted. Acevedo's Bildungsroman is in verse is a stunning account of a teen girl's path to poetry.
Bildungsroman. Can we use that word? I was muted, but I gasped when you read it.
Yeah. Acevedo's poetry is skillfully and gorgeously crafted. Each verse can be savored on its own, but together they create a portrait of a young poet sure to resonate with readers long after the book's end. The verdict was truly a, quote, lantern glowing in the dark for aspiring poets everywhere. All YA collections will want to share and treasure this profoundly moving work. Kirkus gave it a starred review, as did Publishers Weekly. Kirkus said themes as diverse as growing up first-generation American, Latinx culture, sizes of music, burgeoning sexuality, and the power of the written and spoken word are all explored with nuance, poignant and real and beautiful and intense. Publishers Weekly said debut novelist Acevedo's free verse gives Ziamara, how do you pronounce the main character's name? I want to say Ziamara, but I'm not.
Ziamara? Okay. Yeah, because it's on, well, one of her poems goes through that pronunciation.
Okay, Ziamara. Yeah. Okay, all right. Yeah. So I was correct. Ziamara's coming-of-age story, an undeniable pull, its emotionally charged bluntness reflecting her determination and strength. At its heart, this is a complex and sometimes painful exploration of love in its many forms, with Ziamara growing love for herself reigning supreme. The awards were mentioned, in addition to the ones that I already mentioned, it was a book of the year for the young adult in the New Atlantic Independent Booksellers Association. It won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Young Literature. And like I said, it was a National Book Award winner and a Prince Medal winner. It has been challenged. I know it's been challenged more than once, but the one story I could find about its challenge via one of the anti-censorship organizations, and then the Charlotte Observer, because this is in Charlotte, North Carolina, here's a couple of paragraphs from it. So in their lawsuit last month, John and Robin Cole, the parents of a ninth grader at the school that they were challenging the book, said CMR's cryptic musings in The Poet X amounted to a, quote, frontal assault on their family's Christian beliefs and values, thus violating the religious protection spelled out in the U.S. Constitution. The couple asked the federal courts in Charlotte, and this was from, I think, 2021, to issue a temporary restraining order to ban the school from using the book in their son's classroom until their case is resolved. U.S. District Judge Max Coburn refused. The veteran Asheville judge ruled Friday that the Cobles had failed to prove that their child would be harmed by the book or that the school endorsed the novel's criticism of organized religion. He said the sincerity of the plaintiff's religious objections to The Poet X is not disputed, nor is the fact that the book deeply offends them. Even accepting, however, that the work is antithetical to the particular Christian beliefs espoused by the plaintiffs, its inclusion in the high school curriculum alone does not violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, right? You know, the Cobles are Baptist. They took their fight to the U.S. Fourth District while asking the court to overturn Coburn's order. They also sought an emergency injunction from Richmond, Virginia-based judges to block Lake Norman Charter, that's a school, from teaching the book until they rule in the appeal. A three-judge panel, which included North judges from North Carolina unanimously rejected their injunction. Their appeal at that point was still pending. So it's basically like, this offends us religiously, so we want it out of there. Any thoughts on anything about the author, or should we just go ahead and get into the plot?
Do you want me to comment on any of that censorship business, or are we going to talk about the role of religion in the
book? We're definitely going to talk about the role of religion in the book. So if you want to just say that, because it is one of those weird, like, your kid doesn't have to read it if you don't want them to. Why are you so insistent on this? And that's this sort of like, you know, we've seen that tactic over and over, especially in the last few years. So,
yeah. And I think it's another example of, did you read it? ? And did you like consider like what was going on? Because there are a lot of obviously harsh moments in there. And I think the mother requires some empathy, like her background very much informs how she behaves.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that Xiomara at the end brings Father Sean in, like she is, I think, actively using, you know, religion in order to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Or a religious agent in order to speak to her mother. And I think that shows that there is actually a respect level. It's just that this particular person, which is true for a lot of people, is struggling with, you know, Christianity at this moment in time. And I think that that's a realistic thing that happens. And for people to just like speed over and be like, look at what questions she's asking. Like, you're not reading it. You're not engaging with the material to see like she's wrestling with this sort of thing. And that's what happens. And sometimes people leave and sometimes they come back.
Yeah.
It's just like, another one where are they getting their information from?
Yeah. Well, and it's adolescence, right? Which is the period classically where you question the most about yourself and the most about your upbringing and such that. So yeah, it just sounds like a very odd parental control thing more than a parental, you know, rights or whatever you want to call it. All right. So let's go ahead and get into the plot. I got this from Spark Notes. I will say that I found a mistake in the like second sentence of the Spark Notes.
Oh no.
So the book takes place in Harlem, but the Spark Notes say it takes place in Brooklyn. It's like, no.
Yeah, because there's like a line that they considered moving to Brooklyn, but they did not. Yeah.
Yeah, she's literally in Harlem. So Xiomara is 15 years old. She's Dominican American. She's about to start 10th grade. She is tall. She is curvy. And as she sits on the stoop of her in front of her Harlem home, her developing shapely body earns their unwanted sexual attention from the men and drug dealers on her street. Her mother, Mami, M-A-M-I, by the way, insists that it's her fault that men look at her. She lives with her mother. She lives with Mami, Poppy, P-A-P-I, of course, and her brother, Xavier, whom she calls Twin. And that's actually how I will probably be referring to him quite a bit over the course of the discussion. Mami is a devout Catholic who insists that her children be raised in the same faith. She demands that Xiomara attend Catholic church and go to confirmation classes with Father Sean. Xiomara questions the faith, especially what she sees as patriarchal misogyny. She also questions whether the Bible should be read literally instead of metaphorically and sees no evidence of God's interest in or love for her. Mami doesn't share her daughter's skepticism. Church and faith are important to Mami, who wanted to be a nun before she was forced by her family to marry Poppy so she could emigrate to the United States. Their marriage was rocky, with Poppy known in the Harlem neighborhood as a womanizer and cheater. Mami struggled to get pregnant and considers Xiomara and Twin to be miracles, not only because she had children as an older parent, because Poppy stopped drinking and chasing other women after the children were born. Though Xiomara loved feeling like her mommy's little miracle when she was a child, her maturation as a young woman causes strain in her relationship with her. Her mother wants Xiomara to remain pure, and Xiomara is hurt by her mother's inability to see her authentically. The pressure of being her mother's miracle gift from God adds to her stress in her complex inner world, as Xiomara cannot see her life as a gift if she may not live it as she wants. She begins confirmation classes at the same time she starts 10th grade. They're frustrating, and she cannot do what Sean directs and come to the faith of her own free will, of her own volition, which is a word she contemplates heavily. She ultimately decides not to take communion as the gesture feels inauthentic because of her concerns. Her denial of the Eucharist infuriates Mami and adds strain to their increasingly tenuous relationship. In school, however, Xiomara has Miss Galliano for English. She is a tough teacher, but she impresses and inspires Xiomara and encourages her to join the poetry club. Miss Galliano gives her writing assignments. For each assignment, Xiomara writes a rough draft and a final draft, and her rough drafts are always deeply insightful. She writes about family secrets and difficult or uncomfortable experiences. The draft that she hands in, the final draft, is always on the same topic as a rough draft, but the story, while true, is less revealing of her personal background and unseemly family secrets. When Xiomara is paired with a boy named Aman as a lab partner, the two talk. Eventually, she agrees to go to the smoke park to listen to music with Aman, and her cat crush flourishes. Aman asks to read her poetry to him, and he's kind and patient with her, even as he gently pushes boundaries with her physically. The relationship quickly progresses from handholding to kissing. She often thinks about Aman as she pleasures herself alone at night, but feels guilty about it despite how much she enjoys it. Meanwhile,
I just say that she is in the same room as her brother?
Yeah.
Which she mentioned before, but then as that was happening, I'm like, you don't give any mention in that poem that your brother's like feet away from you. I think that's nuts.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I just,
no,
like,
no.
When I read that, I was like, oh, Xavier's right there.
And Twin has a secret, by the way. He's been secretly texting someone. Xiomara knows her parents would not be angry if he was seeing a girl. She suspects the person he's messaging all night is a boy. One day, Twin comes home from his school with a black eye, refusing to talk about it. When Xiomara goes to his school to confront whoever hit him, she sees Twin with a boy she immediately understands is his boyfriend. Twin never comes out to his parents, who would not approve, and both he and Xiomara continue keeping their relationship secret. One day, while Xiomara believes her mother is at work, she and Aman go ice skating. They share a passionate kiss on the train ride home. When she gets home, she hears mommy yelling and realizes that she saw her and Aman kissing on the train. Before Twin can help her escape, mommy drags Xiomara to the Virgin Mary altar and makes her kneel on uncooked rice. Mommy beats her and calls her a whore, and Poppy does nothing. Sore and heartbroken the next day of school, Xiomara gets groped by a boy in front of Aman, and she looks to him for protection. When he doesn't defend her, she hurt by having to always be her own savior, stands up to the boy who touched her and tells Aman to stay away from her too. At church, mommy forces Xiomara to confess her sins to Father Sean, who tells mommy that Xiomara is not ready for confirmation. Mommy is furious and blames Xiomara. Because she does not have to be at confirmation class, Xiomara attends poetry club meetings at Miss Galliano's urging, where she meets Isabel and other writers. Xiomara reads one of her poems aloud when she tells her best friend Caridad about poetry club. Caridad arranges for Xiomara and Twin to join her at Poetry Slam open mic. Although she's scared, she reads aloud and wants to do it again when her spoken word poem is well received. Xiomara spends all her winter break writing new poetry in her notebook. After school begins again, Twin gives Xiomara a new notebook for her birthday. She realizes at school she left her old notebook at home. And after school, mommy is waiting with her notebook, furious about the things Xiomara wrote about her, church, and boys. Mommy burns the notebook while praying aloud. Xiomara responds by reciting her poetry over mommy's prayers. Finally, Poppy takes the destroyed notebook away, and Twin holds mommy back as Xiomara flees. Xiomara calls Aman for help. He meets her and takes her back to his apartment, where they come close to having sex before she asks him to stop. She expects him to be angry and tell her to leave, but he comforts her and they go to sleep. The next day at school, Miss Galliano confronts Xiomara, who tells her everything and says she will talk to mommy. Xiomara, Caridad, and Twin go to Father Sean for help. He counsels the family, and she signs up for a poetry slam. Her parents and Father Sean attend, and Xiomara finally feels somewhat supported by her parents. So that is the SparkNotes version of the plot synopsis for The Poet X. Our first question before we even get into the discussion is, of course, did you like this book?
I'm going to say something almost hyperbolic, but given people should know how much I read and all the types of books that I read, I guess you should take this very seriously. But this is, yes, I love it. And this is one of the best books that I have read in my life, I would say.
Wow.
Yes, yeah, it's very up there.
I absolutely love this book as well. I mean, it was it's one of those books where, you know, I read it the first time, right? And I remember loving it and everything. I was almost a little hesitant the second time because I was like, is it as good as I remember it? You know, like that sort of thing. And it really was. I mean, it's the poetry is really rich. The storytelling is so great. And you really get this character, this girl who is just very vivid, as is the family and everything. So yeah, it's easily out of all the books I've read in the genre, and there's up to like 8 or 9, this is the best one. I think it's the one I judge all the others on, which is a high bar to clear, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about novels in verse. What it works about having the book in this form, could it have been told otherwise? Like, could this have been a prose novel? Would it have been as good? I mean, like, what's your take on this as a, just on the idea of a novel in verse and this book as a novel in verse?
Yeah, as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, and I'm sure I thought about that the first time that I read it, but you can pull any of these pages out or poems out, and it can stand by itself and be its own thing. Obviously, there's context surrounding all of them, but literally they stand apart as their own poem, which I think is just brilliant that all of them are just amazing. But of course, they all come together as this wonderful whole. It's kind of like, you know, a painting where, yeah, you can absolutely be 2 inches from the canvas and see different things. But then when you step back, you kind of see everything and take everything in. So what, you know, it's part knowing the author and her background. And I highly recommend going on YouTube and looking her up and the Rat Ode, which is just amazing. But just the fact that she has this this background, both in poetry as well as in speaking that poetry out loud. And then we, you know, we look at our lead character, which we could call our ex or Xiomara. And I think, man, I just feel like her journey, it really fits. Like the tension with the words. I think it's not only in things that she is saying, but in the spaces between the words and the moments that there isn't anything there. Because she's going through a lot, and you use the word vivid that, you know, this character as well as the other characters in the book are so vivid, and it's true. Like, she's going through some real stuff. And I feel like using poetry and all the rhetorical devices and figurative language that can go with that, as well as the fact that Acevedo can manipulate, well, and really X can manipulate how words are put on the page, whether they're close together or there are spaces apart, whether they're in a line or they're not, like, it really manifests, I think, what she's going through. And I think that something would be lost with the prose, because even if it were a first person point of view, there would just be like too much words. Too many words on the page. And I think this just like gets what needs to be gotten out there in a minimal but powerful way. So yeah, I think it would completely change. And I think it just really works not only with the journey. And it's very much like a form follows function sort of thing, to use like an architectural phrase, because of course, you know, she considers herself the poet X and it's her growth in that way. And so why not have what she's talking about and how she's talking about be the thing that she loves most in the world?
Yeah. And the poetry itself is, it has a musical quality to it that plays that you can hear it and would guide any visualization you have of the characters. It's, you know, so you're not, I'm seeing this character, I'm hearing her narration through the events. I think the other thing that really, really helps too is that Acevedo has a really good understanding of plot. So like the book has a plot structure, and she does not let that kind of fall off for the sake of showing off the poetry. She pays as much attention to the characters and how they're interacting and the plot and where we are going with it and the climactic scene of the novel, et cetera, as she does to crafting those verses. And I think that's one of the things that, like, having those two meld together the way it does makes this such a great book. Because, like, I've read a few others and they can be a little hit or miss. I mentioned A Long Way Down by Jason Reynolds. That is a really good piece of poetry, novel and verse, but that entire book takes place on an elevator. And it would actually be served well if it were dramatized, like as a play. I could see that book being set up as a play. This really kind of needs this form in order to be what it is. The first person point of view novel would not hit as hard. And I don't even think you could, I don't know how you would do this as a movie and keep the richness of the words, right?
Yeah, because, I don't even know.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would do that. I think if you tried to, if you had like a voiceover, if X was voicing over everything, would that come across as like campy?
Yeah. Or if she's talking to the camera or something, it would have to be, it might come off as cheesy or campy, but it would have to be like, you'd have to lean into a concept and make it unconventional as a film. I don't know how well that would land, though. With under the right director might have it there, but I don't know how it would work. But let's talk about her, because she is the main character. She is the poet X, right? She struggles. She struggles through this whole book with her parents, with her religion, with her, understanding of romance and sex. And there is no, there's obviously the masturbation scene you mentioned earlier, but there really is no sex in this book. It gets about as far as, like, I think Eleanor and Park went a little bit farther in terms of like what the two of them were doing, but they really didn't get, there wasn't a lot of sex in that book either. So, and she's 15. So, she's, and a very self-conscious person, and her body is like a huge, a very prominent thing that is a obstacle for her, because mm-hmm. she's 15 years old, but she's tall and she's curvy. So she probably looks older. Then again, I've heard stories of men catcalling girls of all sorts of ages, which is just disgusting. But
We talked about it in The Bluest Eye.
Like, yeah,
that was a big point.
Yeah. So let's talk about how this like informs the narration too, because like it's one of the first things we see is this struggle with her self-image and such. And then like why her mother blames her for it. So like what's going on there?
What's going on with her body? I don't know. Like It's hard when you read this and having read Carrie to not make a comparison, unfortunately. And I don't think it goes that extreme, but even there are like moments I'm like, oh gosh, kneeling on the rice. I understand, but this is intense. It's hard. It's hard like being considered sinful when you have like literally nothing to do with it. And in fact, like you could almost blame the mother because it's genetics. What can you do with that? Like that is her body. And unfortunately we're in a world where that is very much like brought to your attention immediately. If it's not brought to your attention by men, it's going to be brought to your attention by other females, probably of a different race, unfortunately, of the white race. I'll be blunt about it. But I really appreciate, because it's realistic, just this objectification of young girls' bodies, and that she's 16 now. But like this was happening, you know, when she got her period, which of course, you know, this is the period podcast. that was another issue because she got tampons, which now is an issue because folks, there's cyanide and lead in tampons. Come to find out years, decades too late after they've been stuck up everybody's. But anyways, and her mother, like, got really upset about that. Did she say like Catholic girls or good Catholic girls don't use tampons?
Something along that line. Yeah.
Yeah. And then even said like this is too early because I think she got it when she was 11. So there's like a lot of blame and pressure. And I think part of it might be a projection from her mother because of her father. Because her father would probably be going around with women that would be of maybe ex's kind of body type. And so maybe it's like it's a protective thing, but it's like coming across really poorly. But yeah, so she has to like defend herself at every turn. So you see that struggle. And then she's always protecting other people as well. And the one moment where she really needed someone to stand up for her when these guys, I think they grabbed her butt. And then Amon, who kind of a boyfriend, they were at least seeing each other. I don't know if there was a label necessarily, just stood there and didn't do anything. And so she had to defend herself against the guys and then basically told Amon to F off. And just always being cautious. And when they get to the almost sex, and she says no, there's number one, a fear of, is he going to actually listen? And then he does listen. And then the secondary fear is, oh, and now this is like when he kicks me out and gets really upset and he defies all of that. So I feel like, I mean, when you do this, I don't know what you're going to do, but one of the topics when I was talking about this, for my class, which I feel like I was one of the only ones to bring it up. We had different groups, was just like, we could absolutely use this in a discussion with young men about not only objectification, but consent and that, you know, and what that, looks like, but I think I lost track of what your initial question was. No,
you're getting into the because the fat her body being curvy and being tall, it makes her look older than she is. And there's also this very deep racist thing about Black and brown girls' bodies as being almost like sexualized from an early age, aggressively. I don't know if I'm articulating very well, but I've heard a lot of people talk about that, how like there's this innocence applied to white girls, yet it's not applied to Black and brown girls. Yeah. And so she's dealing with that. And she's dealing with what the boys are doing. And I think your point about like using this as a lesson on consent is twofold. One, the thing with Amon, that's perfect because she set a boundary. He's respecting it. And that is something that you don't see enough of without it leading to some sort of conflict, right? Like him feeling, I don't know, inadequate, resentful, you know, like, you know, it's because she's like, oh my God, he's going to break up with me, you know, because I wouldn't put out. And the other thing I think is important is the scene where he, where the guys are, like people are kind of calling her, but the one guy like basically grabs her butt and Amon doesn't do anything. And he's, the way it seems to me is that he's like a deer in the headlights, like, he doesn't strike me as the type of guy who is really experienced with girls and doesn't know what to do. Like he froze in the situation, which she rightfully is annoyed at that because she's like, I have to defend myself again. Like nobody's going to step in to help me, which on one hand, yeah, you probably shouldn't need a guy's help for that. But on the other hand, it's like, yeah, like why don't you have my back, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a difference too with like, yes, she's capable, but also she was surrounded by multiple guys mm-hmm. and he's just standing there. And so I think the visual of that is bad. Like, if he had at least kind of stood next to her and let her handle it or something, or had that communication. But he just stood there and did nothing. So that was the problem.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I think him taking her in after she's run away at the end and then respecting those boundaries, like, kind of is in some way making up for it at least a little bit. But the other thing about that scene where she's groped is that these are boys who feel entitled to her body.
Yeah.
That's something we have to continue to tell young men, that you are not entitled to a girl or woman's body. And unfortunately, you know, I think a lot more of them get it now than they did, like, back, you know, when I was younger. But at the same time, there are a lot who don't and are taught as who are taught that they, you know, that's, you know, boys chase girls, so to speak. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating to hear the kind of like that old, that really tired dress code complaint about, like, you know, women should cover up because that way the guys won't have dirty thoughts. You know, like, you ever heard that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so, and it's just like, so that we're seeing examples of these guys who feel entitled to her body. It's like, no, you're not entitled to anything of hers. And then her mother, I think you're right. She's projecting. On some level, she also doesn't know how to deal with it. And her way to deal with it is to be is to use religion as a forbidding, like a weapon, as something that forbids things. And that that seems like that's always been her approach when it comes to, the religion and everything, that she uses it as you can't, as opposed to, you know, what can you do? What is the good in all this? And that's why she's starting to rebel against it, because she's just like, all she's ever seen is this restrictiveness of it and such.
And I do want to say that X doesn't, she doesn't wear anything provocative, because I don't think she'd really be allowed to. And the only way I think you can tell that this is true is because the Halloween party, when she dresses up as Green Lantern, it's like there's a tension put on what she was wearing, and she had to, like, change her clothing and stuff like that. And also the guys talk about Ciamara even when she's, like, not there, because her first meeting with the poetry club, Isabel, I think her name was, even says, like, are you the freshman that the guys always talk about? And it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Why? Well, and it's just like, I mean, I can't, can you, like, the self-consciousness you must have as a young woman who is endowed, you know, fairly well endowed at the age of, like, 15, 16, like, you're around these boys who are entitled, they're immature. I am sure that my friends and I made a number of comments, maybe not at the girls with you know, larger breasts who went to high school with us, but certainly in passing conversation with one another would bring that up, because, you know, we were immature. and she's like so self-conscious of it. So, and that's one thing that kind of keeps her, and that's one thing that affects her, to kind of be in this shell that she eventually gets out of through the use of the word, the poetry and such. But we get to religion. Now, I was not surprised that her mother was very religious. You know, there are varying degrees of strict adherence to Catholic doctrine among Catholics overall, whether they be Italian Catholics or, you know, in this case, Dominican. But the idea that a Dominican mom would be that very Catholic is not beyond the pale, so to speak. But Catholicism in itself is kind of its own character in the book. So how would you explain that if we're like talking to a bunch of students and stuff, we're going over this, like, you know, how we say, okay, Catholicism in itself is a character. How do we show that? Because I think
how do you, golly, I guess because it literally takes its own space in the form of words, as well as in the experiences that X is going through and the people around her. And it's not only like a location, you know, that she's going to, but mm-hmm. there are these like really big moments that she has. There are big conversations that she has during
confirmation.
Yes, thank you. It's like, what was she going through? Golly, yeah. And I guess is it one of those things where you could kind of, what happens if you take it out of the novel, you know, mm-hmm. and it just completely changes. And I think you can kind of see the effect of that. And everyone has a relationship with it as well, just like, you know, a character can have relationships with other characters. I think Alta Gracia, aka her mom, you know, has a particular relationship with it. X does. X and twins common friend whose name also starts with a C, and I've
Caridad. Was it Caridad?
And then of course Father Sean is as well. So I guess I would kind of treat it like how does it affect the people around it, and that how are people interacting with it on a day to day, and how would the novel change if it didn't exist?
Yeah. Do you both of us were raised in the Christian religion, but in mm-hmm. very different denominations. What do you know of, like, did you have confirmation, like, in your church and everything growing up? Is that the process, or was this like something that was kind of a little bit foreign to you?
It wasn't too foreign. So I was baptized Catholic, mm-hmm. Which I would say, but I guess just being baptized, it just like you're baptized. My mother and then her side of the family were all Catholic. So if I did go to church when I was younger, it was very much a Catholic church. And then when I was in high school, I went to a different denomination. So it wasn't too far from, like, I understood kind of what they were talking about. And it's similar to like there are different Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, like the PCA, Presbyterian Church of America, they'll be they're a bit more fencing of the tables, meaning with communion, you might not be allowed to take it unless you've kind of gone through a course and you've like publicly acknowledged and accepted Jesus as your savior. And I went through a course at PCUSA Church, but that was more about getting to know the church itself and becoming a member. So there are like different things. But yeah, confirmation, like very much like going through the catechisms and like understanding, you know, the tenets of the faith and things like that. But I think it is a pretty big deal with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I was raised Lutheran and we did have confirmation classes. It was interesting because I grew up around a ton of Catholics, right? Because I'm from New York and Long Island. And Catholics do First Communion like when you're like second grade or so. It's like you're young when you do First Communion in Catholic Church. And I didn't have a First Communion in Lutheran Church like until like the week before confirmation or something. So they were kind of like tied together. So when you're talking about how like you couldn't take communion unless you've done the education, so to speak, that rang true for like what I was what I had done when I was in school. And I think confirmation for me was in the ninth, or I think it was the ninth grade, but it was a lot of just classes for an hour or so at night, a couple of times, like once or twice a week. I think it was once a week, and you're really just going through like the catechism and things like that. So getting some like weird mixed messages without getting too much into it, but yeah, I do remember that. So I don't know if Catholics, I mean, hold it in much of a higher regard than you or I would in the denominations where we raised, but I would imagine it's a pretty big deal. I mean, our Catholic Church, St. Lawrence, would have their confirmation ceremony like a weekday. So like a bunch of my classmates were out like one day in ninth grade because they were at confirmation. So it was just kind of like weird to me. But for Mommy and X, it's almost like she's almost treating it like Mommy's almost treating this almost like it's like a bat mitzvah, right? That she's like it's a coming of age ritual. And then like you're almost like fully realized in the eyes of God or something that you've become a woman or something because of this sacrament. And I think it's a sacrament. And so Mommy's whole thing was that she wanted to be a nun, but she was pressured into marrying the father. Like that's a huge amount of almost, I don't want to use the word trauma, but it's almost like almost traumatic, especially considering there's some trauma in the relationship with how he cheated on her and stuff like that. And you're right. She overprotects her daughter, in a way that, I think some people around Mommy's age might agree with the way she's treating her. But also people like Father Sean do see what the problems are. And he's an interesting character because he seems very progressive in a sense. Did he come off as that to you, that like he was more reasonable than say maybe the Catholic priest and nun we read when we read Doubt?
No.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
oh geez. Yeah, well, I have my own Father Sean, so whenever I read that, I always laugh. He's my work husband for 8 years. but yes, yeah, and I like him. I like how he's able to calm Alta Gracia down. And like really, and because I think she probably really trusts him. Mm-hmm. And so he's able to talk to her about the hard things, especially when X is asking all those questions and he doesn't think that maybe it's time for her to go through confirmation and kind of let her wrestle through what she's asking. And yeah, the fact I like that he has this past as a boxer and, you know, kind of this other side of him. So he's not only seems like a hip kind of guy, but someone who's like been through it. And yeah. I think he is practicing, or preaching what he has practiced. I think I'll say it that way. And so that way he might be able to relate more to X, and she might maybe see him as someone she could actually kind of talk to. But yeah, I know that it's still hard to go to those particular classes. And I know it's important to her mother because her mother originally wanted to be a nun. Mm-hmm. And then she's kind of forced to not do that. So yeah, I think it's just she wants her daughter to follow in her footsteps to a certain extent.
Yeah. I get the sense, too, that by the end of the novel, I don't think she's wholly rejected her religion, but I feel like she's on a path toward figuring out what it will be to her. And how she will live with it or in it in a way that is her own as opposed to what her mother has imposed upon her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important because, you know, we're talking adolescents, and adolescents do have a tendency to see the world in a very kind of like binary sort of way that there isn't like, that there's, and sometimes we'll act on kind of more extremes as far as, you know, like quitting religion and things like that. Whereas there is that in between where you could certainly be religious, but there's interpretation of things in certain ways. And I'm not talking about like, you know, kind of like half-assing it and like, you know, only using it when it's convenient for you, but she has a relationship with the Catholic Church and she has a relationship with God that is that she has to figure out how it works for herself. And I think that's part of this book, and I think that's why this book works in a way that it does. and does not make her mother like Carrie White's mom completely, right? You know, there's a little bit more reconciliation in the end. But would people see this as an abusive household if they were reading it?
I think that is the struggle. I think because that was my whole issue, I think, with the attempt to ban it is because, if you're zeroing in on those moments, it seems pretty rough. That whole burn, like, it's really intense. It's really written well.
Yeah.
But that moment where the journal is burning and X is reading or basically her identity poem, mm-hmm. and her mother is, I think, saying Hail Mary, full of grace, I'm pretty sure, or at least a prayer to Mary specifically. And it's like going back and forth and bouncing. I mean, it's pretty crazy. As well as the times, there's one and a half, because there's an attempt of kneeling on rice in front of the Virgin Mary statue.
Yeah, ow.
And so that seems like also really intense. And it both shows the devout nature of the mother. But I think if you are not willing to understand where that's coming from, it is going to seem really abusive. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is... because religious abuse is an actual thing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like, it's teetering on the line.
Yeah.
And I think you could make an argument either way. I think just like with The Reader by Bernard Schlink, empathy does come into play, and just like kind of understanding, does she go a bit far? I do think so. But I at least like am like making an effort to understand where Alta Gracia is coming from. But there's also a big issue, I should also say, is the fact that there's a huge double standard. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's all coming down on X and not on her brother. Like, her brother doesn't get any of this. And I think it's, again, lots of projection, all the things that we've been talking about. But that's, I think, also a big red flag. Because if there was like equal measure, it's like, okay, this is, you know, this household, like, she's very serious about it. But now it's like, no, it's just zooming in on one person. She might be crossing the line a bit. And I think even Father Sean, while he doesn't know the extent of it, I think even in that one moment where he says, like, you know, be calm, Alta Gracia, like, he knows, I think, what she's kind of like, which I think is what's so great about X bringing him in to be a mediator in order to reconcile, or at least, you know, start to communicate with her mother.
Yeah, because X talks about how she finds Catholicism to be like patriarchal, which it is, you know, and the culture she's coming from and her mother and her father are coming from is patriarchal in itself as well. And I'm not trying to sound... I'm not really trying to like bring up stereotypes in here or anything like that, but it does, you get the sense that that is the culture in which they were raised, where it was very, so that's why there's such a double standard with Twin, which when she learns that Twin is gay, she sees the danger that puts him in because it's patriarchal, but that's, you know, but it's also very, very homophobic, right? And she doesn't, who knows what would have happened to him? Would the father have beaten him or something? Which again, I'm extrapolating because it never happens, but
there's a novel out there for Xavier, I'm sure, but
yeah. But I think you make a really, really good point because, and I think it's part of it is that they are Catholic, which is one of the largest sects of Christianity. It's like one of the original ones. So it's not an unheard of religion. She's not Tara Westover and educated where she's like in some sort of fundy cult type of situation where, or Carrie, where it is something that is presented as like a warped version of Christianity. So I think that being within the church and stuff helps us come back to this point where she's, you know, where Father Sean is helpful. Clearly part of her calling the church patriarchal is also tying the way her mother and father act into that too. So, but yeah, there is certainly abuse in some way or another going on here, but it's not like after school special type of, like, very stark type of something. It's way more nuanced, I think, than you might give it credit for upon first pass, right? And the part where she recites her poem as her mother's burning the thing, and her mother is, it's page 306 and page 307 in my book. It's called Verses, and on the left hand side of the page is Xiomara's dialogue, and on the right hand side of the page, right justified, is her mother's, and her mother's is all in Spanish, and it is essentially a Hail Mary. So that's her mother, like you said, like her mother clinging to the most important part of her identity, and then Xiomara reciting her identity poem. So the opposition there, where it's a back and forth of these lines, is really, really well structured. Mm-hmm. And I like the poem. Her poem itself is like, I'm where the X is marked. I arrive battle ready. I'm the indication. I sign myself across the line. The X I am is an armored dress. I clothe myself in every morning. My name is hard to say, and my hands are hard too. I raise them here to build the church of myself. This X was always an omen. That is insanely good.
Yeah.
And really self-assured in a way that toward the beginning of the novel that she wasn't. Because I don't think she would have stood up for herself the way she does if this were a week into the setting of the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Twin.
Yeah.
Xavier. He is, he's struggling. Now, I get the feeling he goes to like a, almost like a magnet school. He's like a high achieving student. So like maybe he's going down to like Stuyvesant or something like that, or which is basically the model for the school that Miles Morales goes to.
Horizon.
Yeah. I think it's supposed to be Stuy, which is in Lower Manhattan, very close to where the former World Trade Center or the World Trade Center site is. So basically magnet school for, I think it's science or STEM or whatever. And so he starts this relationship with the boy, and we briefly talked about, but like you were saying how he has there's a double standard applied to him and everything, but let's consider the amount of pressure he's under too. Like, can you imagine what he's feeling, or what do you think he's feeling as he is at this school being the smart, et cetera?
As a son?
Yeah, as a son.
I guess I don't know. So I'm thinking stereotype wise, if he were, I'd say Indian,
mm-hmm.
I would see that pressure. I guess I don't know enough about Dominican culture for sons mm-hmm. to know what that would be. Now, given the father, there might be lots of pressure to not be his father.
Yeah.
and to succeed and do well. But he still watches anime. Like, he still, you know, kind of messes around, and he gets to, go out with Caridad and X when they all go out together.
Mm-hmm.
So he must not feel it too much, but yeah, I don't know. Like, so that's a big question mark just because I don't know, Dominican familial culture.
Yeah. We don't get into his head a lot. She's pretty protective of him, it seems. And especially because she's like goes down to the school to like beat up the guys who beat him up. So maybe that protection shields him from the pressure he may feel from his father or not. But maybe you're, I think the point you made earlier is right as well, though perhaps he is determined not to be his father. in terms of relationships and such, because he is you could tell he's probably driven in some way that has nothing to do with, like, you know, that has everything to do with, like, success later on and such. But her relationship with him is, like, really is a really good one. It's we haven't seen a ton of brother sister relationships in the books that we've read, you know, in the way that you know, we've obviously seen some, but, like, this is a really nice one that is they're almost like friends in addition to being a brother and a sister, which is really cool, because sometimes you get, you know, brother sister relationships where the one is too overprotective or brother's pain in the ass, you know, that sort of thing, you know, and here we have two people who really do care about each other. So I like that she shows this positive relationship between the two of them, but she's not doing it in the context. It's like you and me against them, you know, like I'm protecting you and we're fighting against our parents because our parents are overbearing. It's like, it seems like they just have a very natural, nice relationship with one another. And I appreciated that about the book, because this book could have gone down a really darker. It gets dark in some of those instances, you know, where with her mother, but it could have gotten a lot darker and a lot scarier for them. And I'm glad that she doesn't go all the way there, because she allows the book to live in a world that is pretty realistic.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I always feel weird saying this phrase, but I do love twins, having twins as students. I think they're a lot of fun. And this one, they're not like super, super close. I think that there is some conflict, you know, between the two of them. He's not super willing to open up to her, and she doesn't really either. But then as, like, things reach ahead, I think that they both see kind of the need for one another. So I feel like it's a well-rounded relationship that we see.
Yeah. So then we have Amon. Now, I looked up the name Amon, it seems that he could be Muslim, he could be Hindu, like South Asian or Middle Eastern. I can't recall. Does she actually define his background at all?
Yeah, I don't remember that she does. I mean, the, like, her description of him, but I don't know that gives us any indication either. No,
I know we never see his parents either.
Correct.
Which I kind of find interesting.
His mother is never coming.
Yeah,
New York, and then his father, I think, works nights.
Mm-hmm. So, which is not uncommon. You know, people, there are tons of kids who just are kind of, it sounds like he's almost like raising himself at this point in some way or another. And he is, like we're saying earlier, he's very nice to her. He unfortunately doesn't stand up for her, but he does treat her well. We'll get to the romance part of it, but music. So, like, music is something that connects the two of them. And they talk about music, they share music. What role does music play? I mean, obviously poetry plays a huge role in this book. Like, what role, in addition to that, does music play? How is it important to her, him, them, etc.?
Yeah, I think very basically I see music as poetry. Because it typically is in some sort of verse form, and then there's just musicality behind it. So I think it's another way for her to connect to somebody else. I find it very romantic. I mean, it's just like a classic, you know, I guess they're using AirPods now, but, you know, just having wearing the same earbud. I guess you couldn't really do that when you had those over the head. I don't know how you did that romantically, but just like inviting someone over to listen to a record or making someone a mixtape. Like I think sharing music just goes back, you know, through time, both romantically as well as maybe platonically. And music is such an art form that I think it works well with this particular book. And it's interesting. I was thinking about this as we were reading it, because the big thing this summer was, or the start of the summer was the whole Kendrick Lamar, Drake.
Oh, God.
And I think that was one of the one of her first questions was like, didn't she ask like Drake or Lamar? I don't know.
I'm flipping through the book.
It was something. And I think he chose, I don't know. You'll have to find it. But I feel like that was actually one of the questions. And Kanye was mentioned, which of course, I don't really like to talk about him anymore. He's like persona non grata now. But yeah, I like how, because not everyone can necessarily be, you know, a poet, because I think he actually writes her a poem at one point. Mm-hmm. And she even says like it wasn't very good. But the fact that somebody wrote it for her, I think, was really big. But music is something that might be more easily accessible for people, because I think it, which is, it's very interesting, because like I said, I consider music poetry. But people, and I guess I'll be less general and say students, like, really have a tough time with poetry and like immediately say they hate it when they haven't tried it, you know. So there's like this something that seems I don't know, elite about it, or like hard to understand and relate to. So it's interesting that hip-hop in this case, because that's really what they're listening to, rap and hip-hop, is just like more accessible to them. So yeah, I think that's a great thing to include here.
Yeah. Amon, by the way, is, no, I'm still looking. She does. Oh, okay. She does get him to, she introduces him to Kendrick, because at one point she does say, she does, what did you think of the Kendrick, when she's texting him? He at one point, page 114, and then he does, which is the name of the poem here, opens up a little bit about his parents. And he is from Trinidad, because he says, I was old enough when I came here that I can remember Trinidad, the palm tree behind my grandma's house, the taste of backyard mangoes, the song and the voice every time someone spoke, et cetera. But yeah, so I think the, you know, it's almost like when you, it's almost like a universal teenage experience to bond over music, right? It doesn't matter like what your background is, at least in the American, in American culture, whether you're white or black or Latinx or whatever, there is some experience that so many of us have about music, pop music, rock music, or whatever, which is ironic that kids can't struggle with poetry, because it's just like, you know, but I get the feeling that poetry feels inaccessible to them, because it's put on in their minds on a pedestal. This is important, profound, interpreted and things like that. So they're setting the bar for it higher than it needs to be when even they approach it, because it's intimidating to them. If you show them some poetry that is accessible and then build them up toward those things that are way more metaphoric or, you know, or older, I think of some of them, they think poetry and they think The Road Not Taken, or they think, you know, Byron, or, you know, like they think it's old, stuffy, white, you know, et cetera. And you show them spoken word poetry, you show them this sort of thing, and it kind of diffuses that, which is really, really cool. I love teaching poetry. Teaching poetry is so much fun. But with music, it's like, yeah, I mean, you mentioned mixtapes. The mixtapes I made for my wife are still in this house. They're terrible.
I'm not surprised. Do you listen to them every now and again?
I don't have a cassette player. I don't have a tape player, but I do. I did make, I think, at least one playlist of. I have the tape, first tape she ever made for me, and I made a playlist of those songs. So I have the tape. We gave one of our wedding when we got married. We got married in 2003. We had two wedding favors. One was a box of two glazed Krispy Kreme donuts, and the other was a seat of mixed CD. And we had put a bunch of songs, like we put our wedding song on there. We put the song we walked into, and we just put a bunch of other songs that we were like, this is just songs that we love or who we are. So the idea that you identify with like the music you listen to and that it becomes part of you is such a going back at least a few generations. And yeah, so I love that she uses that in this book and has them listening together and stuff. I mean, I remember going over to other people's dorm rooms in college and flipping through their CD collection while we hung out, you know, see what do you have? What do you have that I can borrow? What do you have that I might want to get into or that we have in common and stuff like that? It's like, yeah, so it is really important. It breaks the ice for them and becomes something that they bond over. And I think that's, again, the realism in here and that it's of course, it's hip hop. I mean, that's the hip hop began in the Bronx, right? So it's such a part of the culture in New York City. I don't like Kanye either, but I don't know if this was written in 2018, right? So if it's 2024, they ditched Kanye, but they're still talking about Kendrick Lamar, maybe about Drake and Beyonce, you know, bringing in some R&B as well. And things like that. I don't think either of them is talking about Taylor Swift. So
yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like their speed.
Yeah, no. But if we get into the poetry part of it, right? Because the format is obviously poetry and stuff like that. Let's talk about it in the plot, though, because this is how she discovers who she is. This is how she becomes, it's how she finds her voice, right? And we have two adults in X's life who are supportive in a way that her parents aren't. One is Father Sean, right? And Father Sean, I really like as a character because he seems so supportive and understanding and a really good mediator for what's going on. But then we have Mrs. Galliano, who is her English teacher. And she's amazingly supportive and she's encouraging. She gets her to come to the poetry club and stuff like that. Like, it seems to me that like a big thing of this novel is searching out another set of parents because the ones you have, you've seen how flawed they are. So is Miss Galliano interfering with something? Is it as positive a relationship as I see it, or am I just kind of like wrong? And I'm just thinking that of course the teacher's the good guy.
Oh, hashtag teacher goals. I love Miss Galliano. I don't think she is, but I wish that she were white, if only because like it's something to attain, you know, because that is just like something that I would love to be.
I thought she was like Italian.
Yeah, I mean her last name. Yeah, so probably or yeah, that's what I would assume, but I guess we'll see. But just you know, someone that the kids still trust. Like that is my hope, you know, is that even though I'm white, like I want all my students to trust me. And develop a good relationship with them. But yeah, I do not see her as a bad guy. I don't know if that was your question or interfering. I think that she plays the part of a teacher as the teacher should be. So teachers, I mean, it depends obviously on the school, but often, you know, they act in loco parentis, right? In the place of the parents because the parents aren't there. Sometimes teachers see the kids more than parents see the kids throughout the year. Like that's how much students are actually in class. And so you should be like playing that particular role. You shouldn't just be teaching and have like this wall up and there's like no emotional availability. And to a certain extent, there was no emotional availability from X towards the teacher because, and I think you see this very plainly in the assignments that she gives, which I really love that, where she has a rough draft of an assignment for a prompt, but, and it's always in poetic form. And then what she actually turns in is in prose, and it's completely different because she's obviously putting on a mask and isn't really letting Miss Galliano in. But the great thing about her teacher is that she keeps pursuing her. And I think that's often what you have to do, no matter, you know, the walls that the students sometimes put up and don't, you know, obviously not inappropriately, but just like constantly, you know, pursuing their heart and trying to make them see that like you want the best for them, because then she joins the club. And I think there are just some really great moments where X sees that Miss Galliano like legitimately cares for her and is not just fronting, as the kids would say. You know, and then she is the one, she ends up breaking down because she, after that whole burning the poems thing, and she went to Amman, and then like she stayed over there. So she was in her same clothes, and she walked in and immediately Galliano knew that there was something wrong. And then she like ushered her out there, and X broke down right in front of her. So it was, which I think she knew that it was a safe space. And I thought it was really beautiful that, you know, she's encouraging her, like, you need to somehow like chat with your mother, figure things out, and then gave her her personal cell phone number, you know, just in case. So I would say that there is not interference. I think that she is in a supportive role, as she should be, because she's definitely not telling X to do anything that would be devastating to the family. Like, she's actually encouraging reconciliation, and she's like there as a person, like, if you need me, I am here, rather than like, come to me, you don't need anyone else. So I think in all aspects, it's like a really beautiful relationship. I really do hashtag teacher goals. Like, that is honestly the type of teacher that we should all be and strive to be for our students.
Yeah. At the same time, she doesn't force it, which I think is one of the misconceptions that, or the way that we can, that people can misconstrue of like how that relationship needs to develop, because, you know, there are, you and I will see, I mean, I don't know how big your school is. I will see about 130 faces over the course of 2 days. Mm-hmm. And some of them I will have really great relationships with. And some of them are in my class and they do their thing. And I see them again in the hall. And it's really, you know, there's no life-changing moment with the 180 days you're with me. You passed my English class, and you know, to me that's fine, you know. I mean, you know, and there's and you know, and personally, from a personal point of view, there's only so much that I allow emotionally, as far as, you know, because I, you know, sometimes I can be detached, or sometimes I have a wall up because of just past things. But I know how my students will have walls up and things like that. And I find that, yeah, sometimes you do get to those things where like you have a kid who is really quiet, but like you see how good they are at something, right? In my case, it would be writing, because I teach English. I had one student this year who, he was so quiet and like brilliant, and like his writing was so good. And I remember talking to him a couple of times, and it was just like surprised that I liked it so much. I was like, no, this is like really, really good. You keep doing it. And it was really cool to see that he had like straight A's across the board and stuff like that. And you know, just even if it's just like those tiny little interactions are important. Galliano shows that she cares without being too intrusive in her life, and allowing Xiomara to have the space to figure out what that relationship is, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is like really, really important. It almost happens like a little more organically. But she's there for her, and that is like, that's what I love too. It is a great, because it doesn't come off as like some freedom writers crap where it's like, you know, here's the nice white lady That was an old Mad TV sketch called Nice White Lady, which is basically a teacher movie about like the white lady coming into the black school and et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. Dangerous Minds.
Dangerous Minds, Freedom Writers and stuff.
Yeah. Well, we're not looking to be white saviors. We're
Yeah. Well, and that's Galliano is not.
No.
And
no.
And neither is Father Sean. And I don't think Father Sean was white, but either way. Galliano, if she's white, is not a white savior. And I think that's a really, really important thing about this book because there are too many white savior characters like her.
Sure.
And such. And you know, I love how her relationship to poetry really is like the most important relationship in the whole book. Probably more important in this moment for her than Catholicism, mm-hmm. and actually more important than her relationship with Amon. As much as she likes this guy, like the poetry is the thing that is showing her who she is. And I love how it shows the growth of her character as we see her demonstrate those through the writing and then reciting and stuff at the end. Like it really builds up to something that is really, really great. When it comes to the assignments, though, I loved that, too. And this is why I loved it. Aside from the fact that, like, she's obviously putting up walls with the final assignment, which is very, very typical, right? You don't really want to reveal so much. But I've found that when you give an assignment and you have to have them do it in a sort of essay type of format, right? It gets bland very quickly. My AP students, the first thing we do every year, because they're seniors, is their college essay, the Common App essay, because they got to do the thing anyway. So our first unit, we don't even touch the AP stuff until after Labor Day. And then we do 2 weeks where we do a workshop and they write it and they turn it into me and then, you know, they'll revise it and everything. And some of these students, you can hear them talk and they tell you things and stuff like that. And they're interesting people and stuff, but the writing is so boring. It's just like so milquetoast and so bland and so generic. It's just because they're treating it like an essay. It's almost like what she's doing there. It's like, I've got to write an essay as opposed to here's something more raw. And it's like, you know, I want to see raw. And I see sometimes when you give a kid the opportunity to try different things out, and they find their niche, that's when the writing gets better. I see that with my freshmen with the journals we do, where I give them just a huge variety of different stuff, like every different day. And some of the, and they eventually pick the one to turn into me that they like the most. And, you know, when they get to tell stories or they get to do this or that, and it's like in their comfort zone, their strength, like they're really freaking good. And I think what Galliano finally discovers about Ciamara is, you know, obviously gets behind that mask and stuff like that. But I think it's just kind of funny how it's like, yeah, it's such a typical essay assignment where she's like, oh, I'm going to tone it down because it has to sound essayish. So that actually kind of made me laugh.
Yeah. And you don't even know what the actual assignment was. There's just a prompt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's funny to think that Ciamara is just assuming that that's how the assignment should be. And I'm kind of thinking that Galliano would be open to, like, she'd be willing to be open to interpretation or have the assignment be open to interpretation. So accepting those rough drafts, I think she would absolutely love that. I will say one of my favorite moments with Ms. Galliano is when she notices something is up with Ciamara, mm-hmm. and she asks her to wait after class. And in Ciamara's mind, she's like, I'm going to be bouncing. I'm going to, you know, she's not going to hold me. And then she says, like, that woman was tricky because she called me up before the bell rang and had me stand by her desk. So she, like, it was like she knew that X was going to be leaving the classroom. So I thought that was funny.
The final, the end of the book is the final assignment, the first and final draft of assignment 5, where she actually does turn in something that's very honest and is not, you know, and it's explain your favorite quote. And the favorite quote is Psalm chapter 119, verse 130. The unfolding of your words gives light. It gives understanding to the simple. It's just a couple of paragraphs here, but this is where she refers to a poem as a lantern glowing in the dark. And I think it's a great phrase to end on. It was actually in one of the reviews as well. Now, at the end, so we've talked a little bit about the climax of the novel really is the moment when she comes home and her mother burns the journal.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's the big thing at the end with the poetry slam and everybody's there, but that's almost like that can't happen without that confrontation with her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time that's happened, the tension is gone. So the climax being the height of the tension and everything coming to a head. And I guess the one question I would have, because everybody's there and she sees how everybody supports her in a way that in some cases, I don't know if people reading this, some people reading this would be very accepting of that. In other words, like, I wonder if some people would be frustrated by the fact that there is a reconciliation, that she sees, she loves her parents. She sees the support of her parents despite because some of the stuff her mother did was really cruel. And there don't seem to be any consequences for the actions of the parents. Should we be angry that there aren't?
Aren't ramifications?
Yeah, like the parents, just everything seems to be fine at the end. I mean, like, it's...
Well, I don't think it's 100% resolved. Mm-hmm. But what are you looking for? Just that she carries on with this anger against them?
Well, I'm not looking for it. I'm just trying to come at the point of view as somebody who would be annoyed that her parents
seem to get
off light in light of what her mother did to her as far as burning the thing and chasing it and her ruining the house. It's like, oh, she comes back to her mom. In the same way, it's like the same person who would call the house abusive would get angry that there's such a happy ending to this. I don't agree with that hypothetical person. I really like the end of this book, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But like, how do we respond to somebody who would have that criticism of the
book? I think there's a lot of things not seen in the pages. I think it would be unnecessary words put on the page if we were to delve into each and every conversation that Xiomara and Altagracia mm-hmm. had together. But it is clear that they do have several conversations and they're getting back to a place. I don't know that they'll ever be best friends. They were never really best friends. I think symbolically showing that the bracelet was mended and returned to her, I think, is a big step.
Mm-hmm.
And there are like steps. It's not like they had this big blowout. The poetry book was burned and then they're suddenly at the slam contest.
Yeah.
Cause there's definitely, you know, you've got the mediation. She performs a practice poem in front of her parents and her brother, at the house. You know, so there are steps there, but there are obviously gaps that I think would be unnecessary to include in the story. I feel like they're at a good place. They're not like, they still need to work on things. I think that it's clear to me from just looking at the whole book that there's still going to be a struggle for her junior and senior year. And it's probably especially going to be hard her senior year without her brother. But I'm fine with how it ended.
I am too. It strikes me as realistic because, you know, her parents do love her and care about her. They have different ways of showing it. They have and they have different hangups and things. But I can see how this relationship with her is mending as we get to the end of the novel. And it's not, you're right. It's not completely resolved because she's back on the path she was on and she's 15, 16 years old. And she now has time to help that relationship mend and evolve into something that's mature. as opposed to what it was, which is very controlling and immature, obviously, and harsh in many ways. And I like that. I like that it ends on a very hopeful note, and that she's way more realized than she had been at the beginning. But being that she's only 15, she's not a fully realized person either. There's more about her that she's going to discover, right? And there's more about her that her parents are going to discover. And we're not privy to that. But I think that having it go in this direction is really, really good. I think anybody who would complain about that is just short-sighted or doesn't understand nuance, which, not a shocker, people don't get nuance very often. But I do like how I just love how complex this book is.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that I think I read this in 2 days. You know, granted, I had read it before, but like you blow through the book, right? And you're just like, yeah. and you want to go back and reread it because is there something I missed? And it's layered, and I like that about it, where it doesn't allow the simplicity of its structure to make it too simple of a book. This story has an evil parent finding out about a secret art or interest and destroying parent. And damaging it. Overbearing parents and religion, secret love, forbidden sexuality, girl finding herself and giving a big performance. This novel could be one cliche after another. How is it not? Think about all the things that happen. It's like, holy crap. That's like teen movie cliche after teen movie cliche. Yet this is not cliched. Like, how does she pull it off?
Oh, man. I guess it's because Ciamaro just feels so real life. So feel real life and grounded. And I think, again, it's the dearth of words rather than the abundance, because I think if it were prose, then we would be like, oh, gosh, you know, how tropey is this thing? But because we don't have. Yeah. But because we just get into it and there's really no space for excess. I guess that would be my best guess. But also it just seems so realistic. Like, she is a living, breathing person to me.
Yeah. And not only that, she's self-aware in a way that makes her more three-dimensional too. Like, you know, she's not a one note character as far as her struggle or her complaints and things like that. She sees the different sides and shades of different people and really does try to approach it with some maturity, even though she's not a completely mature person because she's a teenager, you know? So, and I think that having her be that narrator and having her be real and almost recognize her own flaws as well is what helps too. That the book, with all of the things that could be a cliche, like I said, has way more of a complexity to it. And Acevedo allows that complexity to take over in places so that it doesn't become ham-handed and such. Mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors. I think this fits all three. And I think it fits all three in some way or another, no matter who you are. Like, I think that somebody, even if they are not Dominican or Catholic, could see the relationship that she has with her parents and feel seen. I think you obviously are seeing a look into somebody who is not like you, right? Mm-hmm. But then I guess that sliding glass door piece is these sort of like, I can walk in and be in this world as well and have that empathy. And I think that's a mark of a really great book. And that's why this is a really great book. What do you think?
Yeah. Do you want to explain what that is? Because I think it might be one of the first times that we mentioned it recently.
We talked about it briefly. It was mentioned in last episode. Books are mirrors when readers see their own lives, obviously, right? Books are windows when they allow readers a view of their own lives and stories that are different from their own. Books become sliding glass doors when readers feel transported into the world of the story, when they feel empathy for the characters. And I find all three in here.
Yeah. How can you explain, if you feel comfortable, how you see it as a mirror for you?
I think on some level, the struggle between pleasing your parents and the expectations on you versus trying to find your passion. It's kind of a fuzzy mirror image. It's more of a window for me, and the sliding glass door part applies. That's where I feel the empathy for her in some way or another.
I wasn't, hopefully you didn't think that I was believing of you saying it. I was just interested. How you would see yourself, in this particular book or an ex. Yeah, I would agree. Personally, I see it all. I mean, obviously, I connect with her on, the female level. It's just unfortunately something that all of us ladies have to go through.
Yeah.
I wish it weren't true. Especially for, you know, I'm up there, I'm old, but you know, to have this happen to us.
You're old.
You know, I've seen my things, my wars, but you know, to have children, you know, still having to battle and have male students, you know, recording them or taking pictures of them, putting them on websites. That's a consistent problem. You know, it's just like Roy said. The sliding glass door, or the window, rather. I love getting this peek into a culture, into a family from a place that I don't have much experience with. And I thought that was great. And also the Spanish. And then the sliding glass door, there are moments where I love the fact that for the window, that there are a lot of moments that the Spanish is not translated. And I like feeling kind of that outsider way. And I can like figure out, you know, to a certain extent, like what is being said. But there's that one poem that is complete. I think it's about the word, was it cuero, which is basically ho. And it's completely in Spanish, and the next you have to flip the page and then it's all in English. So that's like a really prime example of there being, you know, a sliding glass door as well. Like if there's an important moment, to showcase in Spanish, the author also invites you in, as well as X, you know, to experience what that is actually like. And yes, of course, empathy. And I think for all of the characters involved, the biggest mystery I think is the father and trying to figure out, you know, what his deal is, because you have people's idea of what's going on, but you never really have him. But the mother, I think, is the biggest one that I think we are called to better understand, like what she's doing and why she's doing it and what her motivations are. But yeah, for sure, I think that it does all of that.
Yeah. The other window, and this is just kind of a minor thing, but you know, I grew up in the suburbs. And these kids go to school in the city, and seeing how they navigate their lives in school, but then like after school and how they can go to all these places, there seems to be a lot more independence and mobility, with them than there would have been with me as in where I grew up, which was a kind of a suburban small town. And like, I could go places, but you know, she's going all over Manhattan. And so it's kind of cool to see that window into the portrayal of like, what is it to be a high school student in a city that size? So it's a minor thing, but yeah, everything you said, I completely agree with as well. So I guess we have one more question, is this required reading?
Oh, yes, I really believe that this is required reading. I think that you could have so many social, Like, you could very much have a social activism curriculum based off of this particular book,
mm-hmm.
as well as connect it to maybe more, I was going to say ancient. Vintage isn't even right there, but more like traditional poetry,
mm-hmm.
and have, you know, a connection there. I think this is a way to bring students in and maybe foster a love of poetry and also show that it's not scary.
Yeah.
And how beautiful it is. And yeah, golly, all the stuff that goes on, religion, again, yeah, the role of the female, relationships between males and females, having sitting down and chatting with the boys, all of those things, 100% required reading.
I completely agree. It's required reading with an exclamation point at the end of it. I mean, it's just so good. And it does bring you into poetry and another genre. If somebody were to ask you what a poem verse is, this is one of the books I would give them, like, this is where you should start. And all those things we're talking about is for social awareness and such, in a way too. This is what the other thing I like about this is, where you're talking about a social emotional learning and social activism aspect of it. This does not involve a tragedy in the sense of somebody has died. I enjoyed The Hate U Give, right, for instance, but there's a lot of books like The Hate U Give for good reason. I'm not discounting that, but it is refreshing to see a book where the struggle is, we could talk about a lot of these things of culture and society and being an immigrant and such, but there's no larger hate crime or charge need to go with it. So we can do it within the world of almost like the everyday, and or have just a different thing to talk about in addition to all of that as we look at it, because I think there's more to addressing social issues than than just what's like kind of the death and horror show type of thing, which that doesn't mean this replaces it. It's just an addition to it to get another angle or get another aspect of it. So. All right, we have two minor pieces of feedback.
two minor pieces.
Well, it's just a couple of comments. Our feedback on genderqueer will be in the next episode. This is about the one is about the Smut special, and the other one is about Paper Towns. And the Smut, the comment, I was reading the comment thread on the Smut special just to see if anybody had any like long comments or something. Donovan seemed really enthused for the episode. I never heard from him about what he thought of it. Robert Ward sent us a bunch of recommendations and links. And then apparently the two of you had some PMs, and I really want to know what the hell was going on there. Or do I? Do I? Stella's going to be just sending me smut in my DMs.
No, I think it was just recommendations. Okay. I don't think there was anything scandalous going on.
I did appreciate this one comment where he says, when the hosts don't know what a particular kink is, but you do, and then one starts looking it up.
I know. I would have been okay not knowing what nodding is, but Tom had to do it. So now we all know what nodding is.
And then finally, Gene Hendricks about Paper Towns. Stella, I can't believe he thinks Margo left all those clues for him. Margo, I left all those clues for you so you know I was all right. Stella, I still can't believe he thinks she left all those clues for him. And just Gene's like, did I mishear the synopsis?
I don't know what to say.
If you have any comments about this or any of the other books, or feel free to write in or comment and stuff. It's always great to hear. I like that we've been getting more feedback lately too. It's always fun to have this little section at the end of the episode. But we are at the end of the episode, which means that I have one more question. And Stella, you have the pick for next episode. So what are we reading?
I sure do. Yeah. I was actually thinking about doing this one book, and it was a novel in verse. Before you pick the Poet X, and then I emailed you and I said, would you be averse to me picking another novel in verse? And you said no.
Yeah.
And it was going to be All the Way Down by Jason Reinhold,
which I have a copy. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, which you kept talking about. But then
I would recommend the audiobook on that, by the way.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's by Jason Reinhold.
He reads it. He reads it really, really well.
I bet he does.
Yeah.
I recommend going on YouTube and looking up his performance of For Everyone. So, but then a random thing happened where I got Broadway tickets to a particular show, and this show is based off a book, and I haven't read the book. And so I thought I should probably read the book before I see the show in September. And I do know that this book is on your reading list because it's something that you have read in the past. And it is The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton.
Oh.
Yes.
Nice.
So, Pony Boy, here we come.
I'm literally looking at it from across the office room here. I can see it. It's
nothing gold can stay.
Stay gold, Pony Boy.
Yeah. That should be interesting. Never read it.
Diane Lane.
Really?
Anyway. Oh, she plays Cherry Valance in the movie.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So hot. So hot. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh. Now keep it down over there.
No, I'm Shaq. all right. Yes, God. Okay. Yeah, I'm pumped. All right. So until then, thank you very much for listening and take care.
Golly, what should I say as an outro to this one? What sort of funny thing happened? I feel like not
spit
a lot
bars.
Of yeah, I know. Golly. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Always have a support system with you and try something. Be bold. I think that would be my message, because that's certainly, I think that ending to the book where she says, like, because of blank, I can do blank because of blank. That was a super powerful ending. And so good. I think, yeah, hopefully you all listeners have a support system and yeah, try something. Be audacious.
Yeah. All right.
Goodbye.
Good night.
Listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Required Reading with Tom and Stella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.